Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling is a live call-in radio program providing doctrinal dialogue, cultural commentary, and insightful interviews with some of today's foremost Christian authors and leaders. Knowing the Truth is the outreach ministry of the Mountain Bridge Bible Fellowship, located on Highway 25 in Travelers Rest. The goal of the church and the radio program is to seek the glory of God in the salvation of sinners and the sanctification of the saints by the ministry of the Word. For more information, go to www.knowingthetruth.org. Here with today's edition of Knowing the Truth is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Hey, welcome into this edition of the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast. This is Pastor Kevin Bowling. So glad that you joined us on the broadcast today. I was going to say yesterday there for a minute because I was thinking about what I heard yesterday. I was leaving the studio here, and Ted Cruz was doing an interview with a host of one of the other broadcasts here on Christian Talk 660, and he mentioned during that interview that he was going to be pushing for federal legislation to protect state laws defining marriage. In other words, what we're looking at is we're talking about a constitutional amendment that would then codify the sanctity of marriage in the Constitution, the U.S. Constitution. Here's a story about that. This is out of myfoxaustin.com. They say this: Senator Ted Cruz, pushing federal legislation to protect state laws defining marriage. And so in this article here, it goes on to say this: Texas Senator Ted Cruz said Tuesday that he will follow through with a promise to push federal legislation to protect state laws that define marriage. This comes after this week's U.S. Supreme Court decision to let stand rulings that struck down same-sex marriage bans in 5 states and may overturn bans in 6 more states. Senator Ted Cruz was in Austin Tuesday speaking to a group that promotes laws to prevent lawsuit abuse. And while the focus of the midday gathering was on protecting small business, the junior Republican Texas senator later warned the democratic process is under attack by the highest court in the land. Quote, "We're seeing right now an assault on traditional marriage," unquote. Monday, same-sex marriage bans in Indiana, Oklahoma, Utah, Virginia, Wisconsin were essentially kicked to the curb. The U.S. Supreme Court has decided not to make a decision at this time regarding rulings that struck down those laws. In response, Senator Cruz said he will introduce a constitutional amendment to prevent the federal government from overturning any state laws that define marriage. A quote here from Senator Cruz again, it says, "What these courts are doing is wrong. It is judicial activism," unquote. And I totally agree. I think that the time has come for us now to be talking about some serious talk and action about bringing forth a constitutional amendment on the issue of marriage. And the reason that I believe that is the way that the Supreme Court went about doing this was just so egregious and so much usurping the rights of states that I think the time is now upon us where the only recourse that we actually have in order to rectify this situation is with a constitutional amendment. And I know that's a very serious thing in our country. I know that speaks about issues like we've got a constitutional crisis on our hands, these types of things. And I have resisted that type of talk for a long time because I felt that if we could do it at the state level, and we did it at the state level, and many states had voted with an overwhelming majority here in South Carolina, 73% of the populace of South Carolina voted to ban same-sex marriage. And now we see that basically one unelected official has overruled 73% of the people here in the state of South Carolina. That's just wrong. That's wrong, constitutionally wrong. And so since that is taking place with such an egregious overreach or judicial activism, I think now the only way for us to rectify that situation is to push for a constitutional amendment. And I think we have some momentum here, because not just in our own constituencies that are for marriage and against the redefinition of marriage, but I think the broader issue here, too, being introduced, that being about state rights being part of this mix, I think now we may have enough people who see this as being an egregious attack against both of those two things, the sanctity of marriage and state rights, that we may now have the enough momentum to really go at this in a serious way. Well, I want to get some feedback on this, and I want to get some insight on this. And I thought, who better to turn to than Dr. Daniel Heimbach? Daniel Heimbach is a senior professor of Christian ethics at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary. He's also an ordained Southern Baptist minister. He's a fellow at the SBC Ethic and Religious Liberty Commission. He's the chairman of the Christian Ethics Planning Unit for the Evangelical Theological Society. He's the general editor of B&H Christian Ethics Series. And so he certainly is qualified to speak about this issue. He's put together what I think is the seminal work on this particular issue of same-sex marriage. You may remember that I said many times that I thought that Joe Dallas, who was a former head of the Exodus International, he wrote a book called The Gay Christian with a question mark after it. And I had Joe on the broadcast numerous times to talk about that issue, about how that's those two terms are incompatible, gay and Christian, even though that there was this major push to bring those two terms together. And so I kept saying that Joe's work in The Gay Christian was the seminal work on that subject. Well, in a similar way, I think that Dr. Heimbach's work here on Why Not Same-Sex Marriage is the seminal work dealing with the issue of same-sex marriage. The subtitle is this, and this is what is key about this book. It says, it's a manual for defending marriage against radical deconstruction. And I think it's that's an appropriate subtitle for this. This is going to tell you in a number of different ways. We'll talk about those ways in just a few moments. But a number of different ways how to defend traditional marriage and how to face all the array of arguments that are given for allowing same-sex marriage, how to deal with them on an individual basis. It's just a tremendous work. He's done an excellent job. Dr. Heimbach, it's a pleasure to have you back here on the Knowing the Truth radio broadcast.
Thank you, Kevin. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be with you.
Dr. Heimbach, let me let you just respond to the events that have taken place just this past week with the Supreme Court decision or non-decision, however we want to look at it, and then some subsequent thoughts here afterwards about is this where we're at constitutionally to go for a constitutional amendment? Your thoughts?
Well, thank you. Yes, I think that this is really the seminal issue internally with regard to the stability, future, and strength of our culture constitutionally and socially is this battle over the change or redefinition of marriage and the significant consequences. So I don't, you know, there are lots of different issues, moral issues that are being debated and have political expression, presently in our country. And certainly externally, the biggest threat on the life, stability, and survival of American life and society is a militant Islam. And we see that with the rise of ISIS and what's going on now in the Middle East, really reaching a whole new level. Mm-hmm. But internally, we have a tremendous challenge to the life and not only stability but survival, I would say, of American life and culture, and that is the radical deconstruction of marriage. And we can talk about what that means here as we move on in the program. Mm. But you asked what my thoughts were in terms of where we are and in reaction to the Supreme Court. I think it's really important, I think, not to refer to the Supreme Court's action as a decision on the issue. Some who are, you know, are invested in trying to create radical change in our culture are acting as if this is a decision by the Supreme Court that now must be, driven, into lower levels and so forth like this. Certainly, they made a decision, but this is not a Supreme Court case decision. It was a decision not to make a decision, which for the time being allows some very troubling lower court decisions to stand, but they certainly don't affect everybody, and they are not consistent. So I think we need to, tragic what the Supreme Court has done, and I think it does not bode well for us. I think that they are taking a wait and see approach, just allowing this foment to continue when they had an opportunity to really bring it under control. So it was not a very advisable decision. I think it was very alarming in many respects, but it was not a Supreme Court decision in the sense of a Supreme Court creating, Supreme Court precedent with regard to, interpreting marriage and the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So having said that, we are in a position of great confusion as a result of what the Supreme Court did. And what it did was deny appeals from five different states seeking to retain their bans on same-sex marriage. That is, these are states that have explicit bans on same-sex marriage. And actually, I don't like that language either. I think that helps the other side. What these states have are not bans on same-sex marriage, but rather fixing the definition of marriage so that it isn't subject to change by mm-hmm. legislative fiat. That is, so they're not opposing same-sex marriage. They're merely protecting marriage from redefinition. Mm-hmm. So I want to make that clear. But we have a number of lower courts that have made decisions to overturn these state law decisions, and the Supreme Court, in denying their appeal to support their laws on marriage, has thrown the whole situation in great turmoil. Now there are about 11 states that are affected by the Supreme Court's denial, and so their reactions are mixed. Some are going ahead with weddings, even though they have banned them in their state-level constitutions. Others are taking a slower, more deliberate approach that is resisting, but not simply objecting to, and then others are putting up a fight. So it's creating a great deal of confusion, inconsistency, and this is going to continue. It's an opportunity, I think, for those who are concerned about defending marriage to speak up. Now's our time to speak up at a national level, because everybody's paying attention to it. And if we're afraid to speak up or don't know what to say, then I think we'll miss the best opportunity we have to defend marriage.
The opening page of your book says this: never have Americans faced a challenge so severe as the one raised by the present movement to deconstruct the one institution without which no society can survive. That's quite a statement to open this book with, but yet it actually is that important, right?
Absolutely. I believe what I said there, and I think, let me be clear, I think we should be careful about being alarmist. I think I am put off by alarmism. That is where people exaggerate mm-hmm. and where people deal with important issues in an emotional way. We're not going to we shouldn't be addressing this with
hyperbole.
You know, just as a matter of emotion. We may feel deeply. I think we should be passionate, but we should be dispassionate in how we discuss the issue in the public marketplace. So I think we should avoid alarmism, which is intentionally setting reason aside and just pushing passion forward and exaggerating the situation, because we lose credibility on what we do if we take that approach. And as Christians, that's dishonest.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think honesty requires that we be dispassionate. But this is a very, very monumental issue. There could be no greater issue of greater moment in terms of the survivability and stability of our nation. And it really is of that order, because the institution of marriage is, in fact, the most essential social institution we have.
Mm-hmm.
And as a society is never stronger than the strength of its marriage units. And so by destabilizing and redefining marriage, it isn't just a matter of, allowing more people to marry and keeping the same thing. It's a matter of completely, and I use the word very carefully, deconstructing. And this is what the advocates very intentionally say they are doing. That is, to redefine it in a way that has no fixed structure, and redefine it in a way that changes it into something that is just defined by feelings. And if you do, then you can't have an institution, because a public institution has fixed structure. Otherwise, it cannot be maintained, it cannot be defended, it cannot be supported, it cannot be maintained. And if you redefine the meaning of this in a way that is based only on a matter of feelings, whatever they are, no one can tell except the person themselves, then you actually have deinstitutionalized it. And if you deinstitutionalize marriage, it will destroy marriage. It deconstructs it and leaves it with no structure, and therefore it cannot survive.
People might
call things that they're doing marriage, but it is not, in fact, the institution of marriage.
Right. I was speaking on the broadcast the other day about the fact that words have meaning and definitions are important, especially when you're dealing with the law. And that's what was so stunning about this non-decision the other day, or them not taking these cases. I know there's a lot of speculation as to why they didn't, and some are saying that their choice to not take this was actually protecting it at this point, so that it didn't get voted on by them as being, and then set in stone as being a Supreme Court decision. But I think a lot of that is just speculation, because seeing that it dealt with the law, and that there is such a tremendous weight of precedent for traditional marriage, not only from the founding of this country forward to our present day, universally across the globe and all throughout human history. So to have, when the law deals with precedent, to have that tremendous amount of weight of precedent against this, I just can't understand why they didn't defend the law and a state's right to affirm those laws that they had passed on traditional marriage. So they must have known that in not taking this case, it was going to have the effect that it did, basically then legalizing, at least to some level, gay marriage or same-sex marriage throughout so many different states. And they must have known that this appellate judge, in doing this, was usurping the state's rights by just dismissing what the people of those states have voted on. So I don't understand their decision. I'm confused by it. And I'm not hopeful that they're waiting for a more opportune time to confirm marriage. I think that once this horse is let out of the barn, it's going to be a very difficult thing then to go back. What do you do then with all of these cases where people got married in the interim? I just think it makes our case for the establishment of marriage traditional marriage and as strongly as possible, it makes that very much more difficult. Would you agree?
I absolutely do.
Let me go through your book here a little bit and give us help with some of these arguments. I want people to understand how this book is going to help them. Now, you face a number of, as you refer to them here, as arguments. We talk about arguments, of course, is that somebody is going to make a case for why same-sex marriage is okay. And then, of course, we're standing up and then saying why it is not okay. So we've got to be able to deal with those arguments. And what Dr. Heimbach has done in this book is he has listed those arguments for us. I don't know the exact number of the arguments that you have in here.
I stopped at 101.
101. So every conceivable argument.
Evan, let me explain to our listeners what sort of book this is and why I wrote it, and then we can get into some of those arguments. You mentioned the title, Why Not Same-Sex Marriage? Let me make clear for those who may not have seen it, that is not a question. That's a statement, why not same-sex marriage? And the subtitle makes it clear, A Manual for Defending Marriage Against Radical Deconstruction. But I left the main title a little bit vague so that people passing by, seeing it maybe in a bookstore or whatever, might be a bit of a hook to pay attention to it and draw them in, because I wrote the book, yes, to resource those who are already convinced this is a terrible problem, but also to move past that and try to reach what I call the undecided middle part of our population, people who haven't made up their minds or maybe or have inclined one way or the other, but are willing to listen to either side.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a chapter book. There have been a number of chapter books written by both sides, you know, on same-sex marriage and so forth, and probably The Future of Marriage by David Blankenthorne is one of the best, discussing it in secular terms, because we are talking about a civil institution and not just simply a church institution. And although, unfortunately, tragically, I think he has personally compromised now since he's written that book on the issue and is not as strong as he used to be, but the book is very fine. This is not a chapter book, but rather it is a manual. It's a resource manual. And let me explain why I wrote that kind of book. It's because, you know, I've had a fair amount of political experience myself. I worked in Washington, D.C. as a political appointee, and before that I was on Senate staff for a number of years, and I'm very familiar with political campaigns, whether it's for an election to office or whether it's a public policy issue. And one thing that everyone knows, if they have any familiarity with political issues, is that both sides have their hardcore constituency. They've made up their minds and never going to change it. And the issue or the election is won or lost depending on who is most effective at getting their message or influencing the undecided middle, that is, people who are listening to both sides and haven't made up their minds. And what's been happening on the marriage issue in our culture generally is that our side has been writing books that are aimed at the already convinced, that is, to people who already believe that it's a terrible thing and to maybe get them out to vote, but have not been addressing the challenges in the culture and reaching the general marketplace of ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But while the other side has been flooding the general marketplace with all sorts of false ideas to change the way people think about marriage, that, you know, it's not going to affect anybody, it's only going to affect homosexuals, it's a question of equality, it's a question of justice, it's better for children, and so forth, those kinds of ideas. And even though the initial reaction most people have is to say, this is wrong, this doesn't make sense, if they keep hearing it, the more they hear it, and especially if they hear these false ideas and don't hear them refuted, then no matter how scurrilous the opponent's claims might be, if your side doesn't respond and explain that this is wrong and this is why, then the people in the undecided middle begin to change their minds, because they start getting used to it,
mm-hmm.
and because they think, well, if this was wrong, the other side would have explained why it's wrong. So if they haven't objected, it must it must be true. And so we're losing this issue in the public marketplace by default. And so I wanted to write a book that identified all the false claims, and I've been through all the literature and gone through and had to stop somewhere, so I stopped at 101, and I've cataloged them all in different categories, having to do with the nature of marriage, having to do with children, having to do with the Constitution, having to do with, you know, theology, or having to do with philosophy, those kinds of things. I've put them in those categories, and then I've put their false claim in its strongest form, so it isn't a straw man. It really is something that somebody is saying. And then I've written a careful, focused refutation of why that claim is wrong. And then after having done that, I put a sound bite. If they make that claim, this is the one thing you can say. If you just have a minute, if you are writing a letter to the editor or whatever, that you can say that undoes that argument. The tone is written not. It's written to resource Christians who are out in the public marketplace, but it's actually not written. It's not a textbook, and it's not written specifically for Christians. It's written in language that's meant to persuade non-Christians in the secular arena about what's at stake with the civil institution, why changing it is a terrible idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, I certainly hope that it does that. Meets those objectives, but I for one feel that the church is not equipped to defend this, and I think that most people in the popular realm, especially in the secular side of things, that they just hear these popular notions that you address, and those are good enough for them to be persuaded on these issues. They're not thinking about the more nuanced arguments. Because we just don't live in that type of a rationalist society today where people are that rational about what they believe. For instance, Dr. Heimbach was mentioned on the Jon Stewart show. I just watched that again, and it just makes
Thank you for bringing that up.
Yeah, it just mocks him for his statement, but I think that that is what we're dealing with, and you hear the audience applaud rabidly at what he says, even though what he says is the reasoning behind what he says. If they understood that, they themselves would see that it was disturbing the point that you were making, how that we're going to remove any distinction for marriage, and basically it opens a floodgate for people to marry multiple partners, people to marry non-humans, animals, inanimate objects, and so forth. Who's to say, once the definition has been destroyed or opened up to just meaning anything, who's to say that there can't be an emotional connection made between those things? We're going to talk more about this when we come back from the break. I want to go into some of these actual arguments and let Dr. Heimbach give you a flavor for the way that he deals with these in his book. And I want to give you some more information about where to get a copy of this book. I'll tell you that right now. You can get it out on Amazon. Again, it's called Why Not Same-Sex Marriage, A Manual for Defending Marriage Against Radical Deconstruction. It's written by Dr. Daniel Heimbach, and you can get that on Amazon. Just Google it. And if you Google it, you see you can buy it there. Get a copy of this book. You're going to need it. This discussion isn't going away. We'll talk more when we come back from the break.
Welcome back to Knowing the Truth with Pastor Kevin Bowling. Information regarding the resources referenced on today's program can be found at www.knowingthetruth.org. Now, here to continue with today's program is Pastor Kevin Bowling.
Welcome back into the second half of the program today. We're in a fascinating discussion, a very important discussion with Dr. Daniel Heimbach, talking about his book, Why Not Same-Sex Marriage? A Manual for Defending Marriage Against Radical Deconstruction. We need a manual. We need a manual in the church today to understand, first of all, what the issues are, and then to understand what the arguments are against those that hold a different position, and then understand how to refute those arguments. That's what the manual does. That's what this manual does. It gives you the tools necessary to be able to do that. Now, we're talking about doing that, of course, in a not in a belligerent manner. I don't like the fact that we have to go through this disclaimer with this sin only. we don't go through these disclaimers when we're talking to somebody about drunkenness. We don't go through this when we're even other sexual sins like adultery. We don't go through all this, jump through these hoops on these disclaimers to say, well, you know, I'm a sinner myself too, but who am I to speak to you about your adultery or your drunkenness? But this particular sin, because of the political correctness of it, a lot of times, you know, we go out of our way to say that we're not just being hateful, that we're just speaking on the Word of God. But let me just tell you that obviously, as we do with every sin, we're to deal with it in a compassionate and we're to deal with it in a winsome way, standing firm upon the Word of God and upon a sound reason as to why we believe this position that we hold. I mentioned earlier today or in the discussion here that reason seems to be an issue in our society today, even in the church. I think that there's a general anti-intellectualism that pervades the church. I think that the idea of the concept of reason and offering a reasonable argument for something is not the way that many times issues are approached, and that's unfortunate. We need to do that with this. We need to really understand what's being said and then approach it from that standpoint. We're going to continue in our discussion then in order to go through the book a little bit. The opening section of the book speaks about arguments regarding the nature of marriage. And the very first argument that's raised in that section is this statement: same-sex marriage should be allowed because it only concerns homosexuals and does not affect others. Let me toss that question to our guest here today, Dr. Daniel Heimbach. Dr. Heimbach, what is the response to that question that we hear so often today?
Well, thank you, Kevin. This is an example of how people who buy the book might be able to use it, how it would be useful. If you hear someone making that statement, then what you can do is look in the index and see where that claim is made, and then turn to the resource I have, which is just a couple of pages. First of all, summarizing that claim in its strongest form, and then giving a careful, focused, but graciously put explanation of why that claim is wrong. And let me explain, too, with regard to all of these, that we are dealing with civil marriage, not marriage in the church. And if Christians should, if we just say, well, God didn't do it that way, or quote a Bible verse, that would, which might be very true, because it is a divine institution, it is instituted by God, and God does care about it, and there's all kinds of verses in the Bible about that. But if we make that kind of argument with non-believers in the secular arena, it will immediately disqualify us from having any influence on the debate about public policy and law, because they'll say, well, that is your religious conviction, and so public policy and law should not be based on your religious beliefs or on a religious book like the Bible.
And yet I would include that, because if I could just interject for a second, I would include that in the argument, because where it is established is established right as a creative order. It's not established just as something for the church, but for mankind in general. So I would include that argument in it. And I understand that they could just say, well, I don't even believe in God, so that argument is not valid. And I would include it for two reasons. One, because I would try to make the point that, well, this wasn't just to Israel. This isn't just to the church as a whole, to a specific group of people. This is in the creative order of things, and it relates all the way back to that. So And the second reason why I would include it is because I'm going to not just be thinking about making a convert to my argument on what I believe about same-sex marriage, but ultimately, with the gospel in mind, I'm hoping to go beyond that and actually make a convert to Christ at some point as well. So anyways, I would just say to folks that I would include that in the argument, and you know, I understand that the way that they're going to try to dismiss it, but I would just want that stated right up front.
Right. Well, and I agree. Let me make a distinction, though. In the need, in terms of opening a door to evangelism and you know, our eternal destiny, absolutely we should do that. We should not be embarrassed at all to stand up for God and to speak the truth in terms of God's view of reality, which we know from Scripture. We also have to be shrewd. Jesus said that we have to be shrewd as serpents and innocent as doves, and in a society such as we, where there is an institutional separation between church and state, and we're talking about laws that that regulate civil marriage. If we cannot explain in terms that matter to non-Christians why it matters, and can only give reasons that matter that come from the Bible, then we should just limit marriage to the church and practice it our way, and we have no lever with which to explain why it matters to everybody. So I'm talking about how we can respond in a way that will help us win the legal battles and win the public policy battles in a secular arena, because we have to be able to explain why it matters to everybody and not just to Christians, and why it makes sense in terms of the common good and not just from those who have a Christian worldview. So I think we need to involve both. But back to this particular question, for instance, the claim is that allowing same-sex marriage, maybe it should be allowed because, you know, it's only affecting homosexuals. Doesn't affect others. You can marry the way that you want, and nobody's saying that you can't. So that's the claim. But we can respond to that and say, well, everyone in society, not just Christians, but everyone, and not just homosexuals, not just heterosexuals, but everyone in society has a valid stake in opposing same-sex marriage, because marriage is the centerpiece of our entire social structure. It's the most basic of social institutions, and if we remove the gender-based structure of civil marriage, it turns marriage into something which, with no structure at all, that is, a way of simply getting the law to affirm what my private feelings are, whatever they are, and leaves it with no objective structure. Traditional marriage, or marriage as an institution, is a procreational institution. That is, I use the word procreational. That obviously means a male and a female who have a relationship out of which children are produced and raised to be responsible citizens, and it sustains the intergenerational continuity and stability of society. If we say that back away, the law backs away from saying it's a gender-based structure, that it's a procreational institution, and it's merely what we mean by civil marriage is merely to affirm your feelings, then that deconstructs it, leaves it with no structure, and doing so harms everyone because it destroys the one institution without which our society cannot survive. So although singles and same-sex couples can feed children and take them to school, and no society, in fact, is able to endure if it does not encourage men and women to become parents who raise children of their own. That, in fact, is the public interest in affirming marriage. There's no public interest in affirming your private feelings, whatever they are. That's important to individuals. It has a lot to do with motivating them to get married. But the public interest in having laws protecting marriage is not to protect or recognize feelings. It's to encourage and sustain a procreational institution where mothers and fathers, where parents have children and raise responsible children.
Well, let me ask you a question. Let me ask a question
to
from that.
Responsible citizens.
Let me ask a question then from that segment in your book. The opening segment is arguments regarding the nature of marriage, which we started with that first question there. The second segment deals with arguments regarding children and families and two things.
Yeah.
One, we talked about that the compelling interest of the state is about procreation. In other words, children in the marriage are a major point of why the state is interested in this at all. A number of studies have been done to show that children coming from stable, traditional nuclear families are much more likely to be successful by all measurements of success in our society that are in good, stable homes. So that's a proven point. But some of the arguments against it go this way. One, well, then I guess couples that don't have any children, you don't feel that they have equal rights that couples that do have children. Or here's one of the questions right out of your book. It says this: same-sex marriage should be allowed because heterosexuals. Same-sex marriage should be allowed because homosexuals make better parents than biological mothers and fathers. In other words, they're saying that they don't have to be biological parents. They can, just as long as they're a married couple, they can provide to the child what the child needs. They don't have to be biological in order to do that. You would say?
Well, actually, that's an interesting argument that some make. They think it isn't just that homosexuals can be parents too, since biological parents aren't necessary. Just as long as you can feed children, clothe them, and send them to school. Some are actually saying that homosexuals make better parents than biological mothers and fathers, and claim they research that shows that homosexuals are more loving and caring and better adjusted because they're honest with themselves, and therefore they make better parents. Claiming they gay and lesbian couples cooperate with each other more readily and are more attentive parents than heterosexuals. This is amazingly brash, I would say, because I think there's a lot of evidence that that's not the case. But that is how audacious some of these proponents are to even say, we make better parents. And actually, that argument relies on two false premises. The first is that it wrongly supposes that the psychological and emotional well-being of children derives primarily from legal recognition of the marital status of their parents, as opposed to the fact that they are they're biologically their parents. Second, it assumes or it appeals to a number of politically motivated child-bearing studies or child-rearing studies that suffer from a number of flaws, including they're not designed properly, they have inadequate sample sizes based on sample selection. So there's been a lot of politicization of studies to come up with results that then are used to make these kinds of audacious claims.
Mm-hmm. In the third section, it deals with arguments regarding justice and rights. We hear a lot about this one today, but it says the same-sex marriage should be allowed because justice requires treating homosexuals as the same as everyone else. Your response?
Well, thank you. Yes. And what justice requires is that people in the same category be treated the same. And it also requires that people in different categories be treated differently. So it is unjust to treat people that are not the same as if they are the same, and people that are, and also it's unjust to treat people that are different in different relational categories as though they are the same. And so what the justice claim is, and this is very important because it actually is underlying the shift going on in a lot of court decisions, because they're debating whether the Constitution has a right to, this is constitutional this way and that way, but the underlying assumption is that it's a matter of justice is at stake, and these people are not be treated with equal justice. But that presumes that persons in a homosexual relationship are in the same relational category as mothers and fathers are in relationship to children, and that simply is not the case as marriage is traditionally understood and defined, and as our laws were written to protect and reflect. That is, our law, civil marriage, traditionally and in terms of existing law primarily, has assumed that marriage is a procreationally structured institution.
Mm-hmm.
I use that phrasing because, you know, you have a mother, you have a man and a woman. Whether they are fertile, whether they choose to have children or not, those are accidental differences. The structural relationship is a procreational structured institution. And so homosexual relationships, they might be friends, they might have a sexual relationship, but it's not a procreationally structured relationship. It's a completely different relational category. And so to assume that they are in the same category and are unfairly being excluded from something that other people are recognized and supported for is a false notion to assume that they are in the same category. In fact, the whole same-sex marriage drive is to change the definition of marriage so that it's treated as if it's in the same category. And if it's redefined, then it would be unjust to treat homosexual relationships different. The point is, they are assuming the conclusion in order to make the argument, and that's terrible logic. And that's also unjust.
Under the section dealing with arguments regarding constitutional law and the following one regarding government and religion, there's a couple questions there that might be able to be combined, but the first one is same-sex marriage should be allowed because the U.S. Constitution guarantees people the right to privacy. And then under the other section, same-sex marriage should be allowed because government should not favor one view of marriage over another. Let me just combine those two for the sake of time. We have about 3 minutes or so left for the answer, unfortunately. So sorry to do that to you, but if you would respond briefly to those, that would be great.
Understand. Thank you. Let me explain something about the Constitution, and that is that the federal government, according to the Constitution, if you're respecting it, is not all-powerful. And the federal government only has powers that are specifically enumerated in the Constitution. And anything not specifically enumerated in the Constitution is, by the Constitution, reserved to the states. That's what it says at the end of the Constitution, that any power not specifically given to the federal government is reserved to the states. And there's nothing in the Constitution about marriage. In other words, marriage law is a matter of state law, and the Constitution recognizes that.
Mm-hmm.
So what these arguments about constitutional this, constitutional that, are efforts to say, is there something else in the Constitution that is at stake and is somehow being denied by these state laws? Because if it's just up to the states, marriage laws, state laws, they should be consistent with each other, but if they're not, so be it, because it's state law.
Mm-hmm.
One state wants to legalize it, another state doesn't. If one state puts it in their constitution, another state doesn't, that is allowed by the Constitution because it's not the government's business to regulate marriage. There's nothing in the Constitution that says they do. But There are things like equal access before the law and those kinds of things, and so the arguments that are being raised to the federal court system with regard to the Constitution are efforts to try to hang a redefinition or a deconstruction of marriage or a challenge to state laws on something in the Constitution. So one is to say, the courts have recognized a right to privacy in the Supreme Court, Constitution. So maybe that right to privacy includes the right to get for same-sex marriage. So I would say that that argument is confusing private decisions to marry with public the public purposes that justify having laws to protect marriage, and they also confuse private reasons that motivate people to get married with what makes marriage a public institution. The Supreme Court was founded has found that marriage is part of the fundamental right to privacy guaranteed by the 14th Amendment, but the court has never even hinted that this could affect the legal status of same-sex unions. And I mention in the book a couple of cases. The fact that the claim now that same-sex couples are raising through this argument is that the same constitutional right to marry applies to them as applies to procreationally structured relationships. This is not the case, however, as the constitutional right to marry in the Constitution has specifically ruled that out, and they'd have to overturn it or go against a number of precedents that they have. So I would argue that same-sex marriage is wrong because there is, in fact, no right to redefine marriage within the constitutional right to privacy. So that's really what they're arguing, is that they have a right to redefine marriage, and there's no right to redefine marriage in the Constitution.
Exactly, and by introducing something else and calling it by the same name is subversive to and detrimental to the definition of marriage that we hold. So when people say, what's the big deal? How does this impact you? Well, you're taking something and saying it's the same as something else. And in doing that, you're actually subverting the one thing. You're saying that a mother and father are not important in the relationship. You can have two fathers or two mothers. You're denying the importance of the gender that's there. There's a lot of ramifications to it, in other words. Dr. Heimbach, thank you so much for the work that you have done in this book. I want to see about doing some other projects associated along with this that I'll get in touch with you and talk with you about. But thank you so much for putting this together. I pray that the Lord would bless this in the hands of the people here in our country, especially in the church, and that it would be used of God to help us to really bring back marriage the way that it was designed to be and not allow for this radical deconstruction.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, that was Dr. Daniel Heimbach, and we're talking about his book called Why Not Same-Sex Marriage. Get it on Amazon. Remember, Jesus said, "You shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free."